Hello and welcome to Under the Grid, the podcast exploring the history of Milton Keynes from the collections team at Milton Keynes Museum. We delve deep and not so deep into time to tell you some of our favourite things about the area and share our discoveries from working at the museum. I'm Catherine, I'm the archivist.
I'm Tabitha, I'm the archaeology curator and collections conservator.
So before we get into today's episode proper, I have an update from the last episode.
Exciting.
So about the roundabouts and whether they were temporary or not. So the fountain of all knowledge, that is Tim Skelton, who you might remember from our Unbuilt MK episode. He sent me a news cutting after listening to our last episode, and it shed some light on the temporary roundabouts thing. The news cutting is a letter to the Citizen newspaper in March 2015 from James Fletcher, who was the transport planning officer for Bucks County Council when the new city was being designed. And he worked with the Development Corporation to design the road system. And the idea was that the junctions of the grid roads would be controlled by traffic lights. But in the early days, like whilst the roads were still being constructed and the traffic was really light because there wasn't too many people using them, you didn't really need computer-controlled traffic lights. So James Fletcher asked the corporation to put in roundabouts as a temporary measure. So by his account, the roundabouts were meant to be temporary.
Problem solved. Mystery uncovered.
Mystery uncovered. He doesn't elaborate on why they stayed, but he does say that due to the design of Milton Keynes and how dispersed the employment areas are, traffic flow has been much lighter than in most cities, and congestion has been much less. But the main point of his letter is advocating for like a 50 mile per hour speed limit on the grid roads, because that's what they were designed to be safe for, was that speed limit. So, and that was 2015, so that was 7 years ago.
And I agree, I think 50 miles an hour is more than enough to go on the roads.
Yeah, especially, you know, we've got much more traffic now, and if you're zooming from one roundabout to the next, you're actually just like increasing congestion.
Do you prefer the roundabouts, or would you like traffic lights?
I prefer the roundabouts. They just feel more fun now.
Yeah.
I mean, tyres, I don't prefer the roundabouts, but...
No, I agree. When you go into the city centre and suddenly everything is traffic lights, you're like, oh, why am I just stopped here for ages? This isn't fun. Yeah. Now I'm used to the roundabouts as well now.
That's it, isn't it? You get used to it. And I think it has worked really well for traffic flow in Milton Keynes. But we might be getting to a point where we need to look at some things like speed limits and things like that.
Absolutely. Interesting. So speaking of circles and also shedding light on things, because today's theme is talking about objects, I'm going to talk about my favourite object in the museum, which is a wooden solar wheel from the Romano-British site at Wavendon Gate.
Ooh.
So this object is maybe 30 centimetres tall, it's circular, and it has cut out ovals that make a sun or a flower pattern in the carved wood. Mm-hmm. The sun shape is carved out of a large piece of wood, and then it tapers down to a shaft, which is also carved out of the same piece of wood. And then there's a hole through the shaft, so it looks like it should have been nailed onto something.
Oh yeah.
It's incredibly well preserved. We have over half of the object surviving, and it suffered next to no shrinkage during conservation. So it's basically the size it would have been.
How would it have been so well preserved?
So it was found in a pit that would have been waterlogged. So when wood is waterlogged, it gets swollen with all the water, and so it maintains the shape. And Milton Keynes has a really clay-based soil, so what happens is that clay then adds to the really good levels of preservation, because it creates an environment where oxygen doesn't get in or out.
Oh, nice.
So you don't have deterioration. And also, when it was excavated, it was sent off for conservation very quickly. When you conserve wood, what you do is you basically put it in a bath of what's called PEG. It's like a wax. And the wax basically takes the place of the water, so it doesn't collapse on itself. And then what you have to do is you have to then put it in a vacuum, and the vacuum sucks all the water out without getting rid of the wax. And so that's what holds its shape. It's a really complicated process. It takes months, and it's really expensive. So the fact that this object was treated that way is really good for us, because that's why it's so well preserved. But not a lot of objects are given that level of priority, given that kind of importance. There's
Does
only
it
like,
imply its significance then?
I think so, yeah. It implies how well the Milton Keynes archaeological unit were able to look after things and actually go, no, this needs to be dealt with. And it's also, you know, a comment on the Development Corporation, right, to be able to have the funds to then look after what's coming out of the ground.
Yeah.
So all around, it's a pat on the back for the archaeology that's been done before us.
Yes, well done, everyone.
But what's interesting about the wheel, so we believe it was affixed to a large post that was next to a pond, and that pond is what it is later buried in. Mm-hmm. So a post hole, which is an archaeology term to mean this is a dip that you would have put a post into, like a timber, was found near that pond. And it was also filled in with stones, and then it was dug around in a horseshoe ditch. So that means it's quite important, right? If you're making the effort to put a big piece of wood in the ground, put stones around it so it's not going to fall down, and then dig a ditch around it, it's obviously going to be something significant. And what's more is that in that post hole, so underneath where the post would have been, they found a rooster burial.
Oh.
So a rooster burial is really interesting. The bird, they know from the evidence that the bird was actually defleshed and disarticulated before being buried. So they didn't just kill a rooster and shove it in the ground. They took off all the flesh, all the skin, and then buried it, which is weird.
Yeah, that's a whole thing, isn't it?
It is 100% a whole thing. And this is probably the one case where you can find that in the ground and go, that is ritual.
Yeah.
Because why else would you go through that much effort?
Absolutely.
What's interesting is that this actually happens in disused grain storage pits in Iron Age Britain. So we have evidence of it from Danesbury, where partial animal bodies are deposited. And normally they're considered as sacrifices to like underworld deities, some kind of thing that lives below the ground.
Okay, yep.
So that's quite interesting. And that is attested in Rome as well. So we know it's a cross-culture thing.
Oh, wow.
Roosters are really common as sacrifices to Mercury. He is a Roman god whose symbol is the rooster.
Oh, yeah.
And we know that at the shrine in Uli, there's rooster burials. Mm-hmm. So, interesting. Caesar, who wrote De Bello Gallico, telling us about all the people in Iron Age France and Iron Age Britain, says that the British shun the flesh of chickens.
Oh.
So it was defleshed, but maybe not for consumption.
No.
So that's another weird thing about it. But Caesar says that. However, there's lots of evidence of them eating chicken and roosters in Iron Age Britain. So we think that Caesar was probably just a liar.
Just making things up.
Or maybe Iron Age Brits didn't like chicken nuggets. I'm not here to judge.
Wow.
it's their choice. But basically, as I mentioned before, the wheel was found in a waterlogged pit alongside various other things, wooden objects, including part of a box, a broken writing tablet, some hobnailed leather shoes, an iron spear, and some pottery.
Mm-hmm.
So quite a weird assortment of things.
Weird array.
It's unclear what the pit was doing next to this post with a wheel on it. There's nothing else structural in this area.
Okay.
We've got tons of buildings on the site of Wavendon, of where people lived, and then this area is just clear of everything except for this post and this pond.
Is it further away from
It's in the middle.
It's in the middle of where everyone lived?
Yeah.
Interesting.
So it's quite weird. There's a couple of theories. Some theories are quite mundane, so that it was a borrow or a quarry pit. So basically they were digging it to get clay to make their pottery. Wavendon Great has a massive pottery production site, but not in the 3rd century, which is when this comes from.
Oh.
So that theory doesn't really get supported. Another theory is that it is literally just a pond or a waterhole.
Yeah.
For animals.
Yeah.
You've got your animals around your house, it's in the middle of the site, it's the easiest place.
Tottle out to drink.
Yeah, basically. And the pollen analysis indicates that the pond might actually have been used for irrigating domestic plants. Again, it's in the middle, it's going to be the easiest place to get to your small-scale planting rather than the big fields.
Yeah.
There's also steps built into the side of the pond, which mm-hmm. would indicate that it had a changing water level that always needed to be accessed. So thinking of it as something to give water to animals, to give water to domestic plants, that makes sense. And the last theory, which is obviously the one I like, is that it is ritual in nature. there's lots of evidence in the ancient world, and especially in Roman context and also Iron Age context, for bodies of standing water being significant for religion. Deep holes always indicate things related to the underworld. There's a long tradition of throwing things into bodies of water and ascribing magical properties to them throughout history. You just think of King Arthur for that, and yeah. Lady of the Lake with the sword. That is 100% coming from Iron Age tradition.
Like a wishing well.
Exactly. Exactly. We still have that today. And this is obviously standing water. There's no river or stream that feeds this pit. What's actually interesting is that all these theories could be true. It could literally be all of them. It could have been a borrow pit for clay. It could then have been used as a pond. And just because something is used for an everyday activity, it doesn't mean it can't have religious significance. Like you said with wells.
Yeah.
A well, you're still going to get water out of it, but also you can chuck money in it. So that's the other thing to remember is, you know, things definitely have multi-purpose. But it's the actual stuff that's in the well that's more interesting, which indicates that even if it didn't have a ritual purpose when it was open, it was clearly closed. It was clearly filled in with a ritual purpose. Otherwise, why are you just throwing shoes and wooden objects and a wooden wheel into this hole? It makes no sense.
Yeah.
Because none of the objects are broken. That's the thing. It's not old, half-used shoes. It's perfectly intact. Well, for 2,000 years old, it's perfectly intact leather shoes.
And they've not just, like, thrown them in. Maybe they've gently placed them in there?
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing. It's not. It doesn't seem to be haphazard in how they've done it. So, in summary, we've got a funny little sun nailed to a post with nothing around it except the pond. So, you know, thanks, Romans. like, what does this mean? I think it's pretty clear it's a religious symbol. It serves no purpose.
Yeah.
What's quite interesting is that the holes in the circle, when you look at the wheel, you might think that the design is actually the filled-in areas, the spokes where it's wooden.
Okay.
But if you look through it with a light and you can get it to silhouette on the floor, it's actually the gaps that make that flower pattern, that make that sun pattern.
Okay.
And I tested this. I made a paper version of it and I taped it to a broom pole and I went outside and just following the sun.
I've seen that in the office and I had no idea what it was. I was like, I won't ask.
It was me trying to simulate how high it had to be to get a design to cast on the floor.
Oh.
And it doesn't have to be that high. So
have we got pictures? We'll post some pictures.
I can take some pictures because I had one hand like this and then looking on the floor. I didn't take any pictures of the shadow, but I can
get
some.
We've got the actual wheel though.
Yeah, we do have the actual wheel. We've got good pictures of the actual wheel, so we'll definitely link those. And I wonder if actually, depending on how high this timber was, because we don't know, if it was high enough that the design reflected on the pond, think of how cool that would be, like a shimmery kind of sun pattern.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure.
That would be quite magical.
It would be quite magical, absolutely. So the question though is that, like, what is it literally just a sun pattern? Does this have any relation to Roman religion or things like that? And this is where it gets a bit difficult.
Okay.
So there's an object called a Jupiter column, which is attested in ancient texts, and it's basically a stone carved column that's made to look like wood with an image of Jupiter on the top. Unfortunately, these don't actually survive in the archaeological record. We know about them from textual evidence, and we know about quote-unquote recreations of them during the Renaissance period.
Oh, yeah.
But we actually don't know, like, what one, a complete one, looks like. But what's interesting is that some of the recreation ones actually have the solar symbol, like the wheel that we have actually on the side of the Jupiter on the top of these.
Okay.
So we wonder if maybe there is some correlation, because why would you make stone look like wood? It's because you're emulating a wooden object.
Mm-hmm.
So is it possible that this is a really, really, you know, abstract version of a Jupiter column?
Okay.
Maybe. Unfortunately, there's no evidence to compare it to. The archaeologist who originally wrote about this object, Miranda Aldhouse Green, argues that it's not a sun disk, but it's actually a wheel to the Iron Age god Tyrannus. Now, if you don't know who Tyrannus is, that's fine, because he's super obscure. In fact, the only evidence of Tyrannus in the UK is when he is syncretized, which is a fancy word that means merged, with Jupiter. And you find images on altars to Jupiter Tyrannus, and Jupiter Tyrannus is always shown with the wheel floating next to him.
Oh, right, yeah.
The problem with then saying, well, the wheel is the Tyrannus symbol, is that there are a lot of images of Jupiter, not Jupiter Tyrannus, but just Jupiter on his own, across Europe, that actually just show Jupiter with the wheel. There's one in Croatia, there's a couple in Germany, and because we have yet to find an image of Tyrannus on his own, there's no way of knowing that that's his image and not Jupiter's image, when the evidence seems to look like it's actually Jupiter's image. Now, the caveat here, because I will always play devil's advocate to my own theories that I want to push, is that there are some Gallic statues from the Roman period of unidentified gods with wheels.
Okay.
But because they're unidentified, we have no idea who it is. Is it Tranis? Is it Jupiter? Is it some other French dude that we have no idea about? We don't know.
They could have just written their names next to them.
But that's the thing, like, a lot of ancient cultures did.
Yeah.
And it's like, what are you doing, guys? Like, come on, get with the program.
Be consistent.
But what's interesting is that even if it is a solar wheel, it's not necessarily tied to Tranis or Jupiter at all. Because there's a bunch of other solar gods during the 3rd century. You've got Mithras, you've got Sol Invictus, you've got other versions of Jupiter. Jupiter Dolichensis is immensely popular in the 3rd century. So other than going, yeah, it's pretty clear this is a solar wheel, it's actually very difficult to then work out who this god might be relation to.
Yes. And different gods are bigger in different areas, aren't they?
Exactly. Exactly. So I have to mention my own theory, of course, because where would I be without pushing my own agenda? But I mentioned Mithras before.
Mm-hmm.
So I've mentioned before some of the potential Mithraic elements of Bancroft.
Yeah.
I think last Christmas, actually, I talked about Mithras.
We told you about Mithras.
There's definitely a song there.
It rhymes.
100%. Roosters are associated with Mercury. Said that before, but we know that Mercury has no association to the sun as himself, but he is associated with the first level of Mithraic initiation.
Oh,
so in that way, there's a tangential relationship between Mithras and Mercury.
Mm-hmm.
On the other side, roosters are just associated with the sun because they caw really loudly in the morning and wake everyone up.
Yep.
You don't have an alarm clock in Iron Age Britain because you don't have electricity, so you're going to need something. You've got your rooster. So it's possible that's going too far, because obviously there's very clear analogies between the sun rising and roosters. So what other animal are you going to associate with the sun? But potentially. Why I like this object is because there's no right or wrong answer.
Yeah.
It's completely, you can have a theory and you can support your theory all you want, but there's no evidence to disprove other theories right now.
Yes.
Which is why it's such a interesting object to actually talk about, right? Is what does this mean? And there's the physical level of its ritual. It's a sun disc. We like to worship the sun because we barely have it in the UK. So you got to have something, right?
Yep.
But who, more attestation of who this object might be too, is it's really fun to try and work it out.
Yeah, I like that. It's very, as you say, nobody's wrong, really, and you can try and get more evidence to prove your theory or somebody else's theory, but in the end, it's possible that we will never know.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you have any strong feelings on sun gods in 3rd century Roman Britain, do let us know.
We just need to know what we need to do more of to get more sun.
Absolutely. And I think having a weird little sun disc on a pole is a pretty good start.
Yes. Unfortunately, we don't have it on display yet, but should hopefully be going on display soon.
Yeah, in our upcoming ancient galleries, it will be going on display, so you will be able to all come admire the sun disc.
Yeah, and make up your own theories.
Absolutely.
About it.
Maybe we can make a replica on a big stick outside.
Yes. Over the pond.
Now we're talking. Oh, there we go. That's experimental archaeology in the works.
Yeah.
Stay tuned. We might have an update.
That would be amazing. Did you know that we used to have a tramway in the area?
I think I've heard about this.
Yes. So all my favourite cities have trams. San Francisco, Melbourne, Manchester, and Milton Keynes.
Three of those begin with M as well.
Weird. Ooh. So between 1887... and 1926, there was a tramway that ran between Stony Stratford and Wolverton. And the object I want to talk about today is the tram car that we have in the Hall of Transport. In 1887, the Wolverton Carriage and Wagon Works had been open for about 50 years, but it was still expanding. Wolverton was growing and more jobs were being created at McCorkadale's Printing Works as well. So hundreds of workers were travelling between Wolverton and Stony Stratford at that time, either on foot or by bicycle. There was a horse-drawn bus, but it cost 6 shillings a trip, which in today's money is about £2.
So, like, the current bus?
Yeah.
Incredible.
So if you were going, like, to work and then back again, that's, like, £4 a day. So there was a gap in the market for some cheaper transport, and the tramway started being constructed in 1886, opening for passengers in 1887. There was an extension to Dean's Hanger for a couple of years, but it closed because it wasn't profitable enough. Maybe there weren't enough people in Dean's Hanger.
It's because they all wanted to go to Passenham instead. Yeah. It's way more fun.
It's way more fun. But whilst it was running, there was a little depot in Old Stratford on the corner of Watling Street and Dean's Hanger Road. So the trams could be housed and maintained there that went to Dean's Hanger. But the main depot was in Stony Stratford on Wolverton Road. Tickets cost 2 shillings a trip, so much cheaper than the bus.
Half the price of the bus.
A third of the price. Oh, 6 shillings was the bus. Better.
And I guess they don't do yearly passes on those.
No, but you could purchase a weekly ticket, which entitled you to 4 rides a day.
That's incredible.
That's double if you were going like to work and back. You could also go to work and back again if you wanted.
Was there nothing else to do in Wolverton?
Apparently not. The tram was powered by steam locomotive, and so it was a steam tram. And this kind of transportation really only flourished for about 20 years at the end of the 19th century.
That's a shame.
But in fact, the Stony Stratford to Wolverton tram was the last steam tramway operating in the UK. And there are some stories of unusual passengers. So the majority of passengers were commuters to Wolverton Works, right? And apparently wives would cook their working husbands a hot lunch and send it on the tram to Wolverton, where it would be kept warm until the lunch break.
How would they keep it warm on the tram?
I don't know. It was not very far.
Oh, that's true, that's true.
It's only a little while.
How, like, what was the speed the trams could go? Like, how long did it take?
Oh. The trams could go about 8 to 9 miles an hour.
Oh.
So, not very fast. It was said that, like a young man on a bicycle could ride faster than the tram. But, you know, it was a comfortable ride.
Yeah.
So, yeah. At certain times of the day, like, another passenger might share the tram car with some piping hot food in a little basket.
I mean, I'd just be tempted to eat it.
I know. I'm wondering, like, why didn't they get sort of stolen? Maybe the conductor was, like, keeping an eye on people.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Although the smells in that car would have been amazing.
Oh, absolutely. Well, then you just get really hungry.
Make you really hungry.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to be commuting during the day.
No. And then at the other end, they'd like keep it in a little little boxes with their works number on. And when it was lunchtime, like, they'd just find their number and get their lunch.
That's incredible. It's really cute.
One of the conductors was known as Little Billy. He was Mr. Newton, who I presume his first name was William. he was under 5 feet tall and apparently very jovial and friendly. I do like a friendly conductor.
Yeah, absolutely.
It always makes the trip better. On the 29th of August 1913, the Wolverton Express reported an accident that had happened on the tram.
Oh no.
And it's not a very long report, so I'll read it out. A number of soldiers and some contractors' men got on the tram on Saturday night, and the tram being crowded and boys being boys, one or two climbed onto the roof of the tram. Things went on quietly until Mill Drive was reached, when one of the men pitched off. With some difficulty, the tram was stopped, and a number of the male passengers started back along the road to find his body, fully expecting to find him half dead. However, although he was severely bruised, no bones had been broken, and the incident terminated with a good deal of grumbling from the conductor and a joke in the camp. Now, like, if you've seen the tram that's in the Hall of Transport, you've seen how high it is. It's ginormous. To come off the top of the roof and fall off and not be injured is a miracle, I think.
It just fell really well.
Yeah.
Maybe he, like, hit the side on the way down and slowed in.
Slowed down. Slowed his descent.
I mean, haven't we all had crazy bus drives, though, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I've never fallen off a roof, though.
I've never fallen off a roof, but, you know, there's always a first time for everything.
Yes. And one of the reasons I think the tram is so fantastic is because of its restoration. So the way you see it displayed in the Hall of Transport today is very, very far from how it arrived at the museum. And it's a real testament and demonstration of, like, the hard work of the museum's volunteers. When the tramway closed in 1926, the tram cars were sold off, and many of them were, like, chopped in two and then sold off as two parts. After the museum was started in 1972-73, members of the Stacey Hill Society rescued two parts of a tram car and transported them back to Stacey Hill Farm, which is where we are today. And when they got them here, it was discovered they were matching halves of number two tram car. So they were reunited after Brilliant. 50 years, which is amazing.
That's crazy. I didn't know that they were split in two. Yeah. You can't see anything.
No.
That is insane.
It's really good, isn't it? They were put on display as they were, but they were in quite poor condition. And you weren't really able to see, like, as I said, the ginormous size of the car. So the planning of the Hall of Transport in 1996 gave, like, the team the impetus to undertake a restoration project on the tram car. So a small team of dedicated volunteers spent a couple of years, like, piecing the two halves back together, refurbishing the panelling on the lower deck and reconstructing the seating. And the upper deck had completely disappeared, but we've still got the plans for the tram cars. And so the team were able to reconstruct it, along with the long gone spiral staircase as well. And then it was painted the plum colour of when it was operated by the London and North Western Railway in its last few years. That would have been like the 1920s. Before then it was operated by a group of, like, local businessmen. But towards the end of its life, the LNWR took it on. And so it's been painted in those colours of how it would have been towards the end of its life.
That is incredible.
And so it's a really important piece of local and national history. One of the successful steam tramways and the last one to operate. But it's also, like, a vital method of commuting to work for local people for those years that it was operating. So when you visit the Hall of Transport and see it, make sure you spare a thought for the amazing hard work that went into allowing us to see how it would have looked 100 years ago.
It's so sad that we don't have trams in more places.
They are so cool.
Public transport is already struggling as a thing, which you shouldn't be, because public transport's really good.
Yeah, but, and it's the solution to, you know, the huge car problem. But
absolutely. You should bring trams back, steam-powered trams.
Yes.
That's all we need.
We'll start a petition.
Yeah. That's so crazy how much restoration work has gone into that.
I know, so much hard work. And to see it today, it looks new, doesn't it, really?
It does look new. And the fact that you were able to not only look at the tram, but on certain occasions you are able to actually go in and upstairs as well, and to think about how much restoration work goes into that, to actually be able to make it not functional because it doesn't move anywhere, but for you to be able to experience kind of the spaces, because that's so key. It's so key to understanding history, is to be able to go into a space and sit somewhere and go, oh, I can imagine this moving back and forth.
Yeah, I can imagine somebody's lunch sitting next to me on the tram. I can imagine somebody falling off the roof.
Yeah, absolutely. We think about, I guess the food must have been on the bottom level of the tram, because the top level, the seats are quite slanted.
Yeah.
So I feel like you'd end up getting your food and it would just all be, like, on one side of the lunchbox.
Yeah. Maybe at certain timetables in the day, like, downstairs was reserved for lunches and everyone else had to sit upstairs.
Oh, goodness.
Well, that's it for today. We'll wish you a Merry Christmas, I guess.
And a Happy New Year.
Yeah.
And we'll see you all in the new year.
That's it for this episode. If you've got an idea for a future topic you'd like us to feature, then get in touch with us via social media. We're at MK Museum on Twitter and Facebook, and at Milton Keynes Museum on Instagram. Also, check out our website, miltonkeynesmuseum.org.uk.